At sea, sleep became the ultimate luxury, a solace nearly impossible to come by. The crew took naps whenever they could, night or day. Hammocks had yet to be introduced on board ships, so exhausted sailors appropriated a plank, or better still, a sheltered area of the deck where they could sprawl. They eased the wood's bruising hardness with a straw pallet and shielded themselves against the cold and wet with heavy blankets. Even then, comfort eluded them. The men never became accustomed to the foul odors brewing aboard their ships. Water seeping into the hold stank, despite the efforts to disinfect it with vinegar. Animals such as cows and pigs added to the reek, as did the slowly rotting food supply and the sickening smell of salted fish wafting from the hold. Pests were ubiquitous, an inescapable fact of life at sea. Pteridos, or shipworms, bored through the hull. Rats and mice infested every ship. The men of the Armada de Malacca were plagued with all manner of lice, bedbugs, and cockroaches. Even worse, weevils invaded the hardtack, and it was further contaminated with the urine and feces of rodents. Crew members with growling stomachs forced themselves to overcome their inhibitions and swallow this disgusting, contaminated provender. Magellan's crew was overwhelmingly Castilian and Portuguese, but representatives of every major country in Western Europe, as well as North Africa, Greece, Rhodes, and Sicily, filled the ranks. Their number included alliances of natural enemies, Britons and Basques, Flemish and French, all speaking in mutually unintelligible tongues. The common language aboard Magellan's fleet was nautical Castilian, which contained specialized terms for every line, clue, and device to be found aboard the ships. The men quickly left behind the identities they had maintained on land for those imposed on them at sea. No longer did it matter if they were Castilians, Greeks, Portuguese, or Genoese. Life aboard ship was lived according to a rigid social structure, segregating men who nonetheless lived in extremely close quarters and who depended on each other for their survival. A strict division of labor ruled over all. At the bottom were the pages, assigned to the ships in pairs. Many pages were mere children, as young as 8. None was older than 15. They were commonly orphans. Not all pages were created equal. Some had been virtually kidnapped from the quays of Seville and pressed into service. If they had not been on ships, they would have been roaming the streets, learning to pick pockets and getting into minor scrapes. They were treated harshly, exploited shamelessly, deprived of adequate pay, and occasionally made the victims of sexual predators among older crew members. Their chores included scrubbing the decks with salt water hauled from the sea in buckets, serving and cleaning after meals, and performing any menial task assigned to them. Another class of page lived a very different life, privileged and relatively free of demand, under the protection of officers. These hand-picked young men generally came from good, well-connected families and worked as apprentices for their protectors. They were expected to learn their trade and to rise through the ranks. Their duties were far lighter than those of the unfortunate boys who had been pressed into service. The privileged pages maintained the 16 Venetian sand clocks, or ampolletas, carried by Magellan's ships. Basically a large hourglass, the sand clock had been in use since Egyptian times. It was essential for both timekeeping and for navigation. The ampolletas consisted of a glass vessel divided into two compartments. The upper chamber contained a quantity of sand trickling into the lower over a precisely measured period of time, usually a half hour or an hour. Maintaining the ampolletas was simple enough. The pages turned them over every half hour, night and day. But the task was critical. Aboard a swaying ship, the ampolletas were the only reliable timepiece, and the captain depended on them for dead reckoning and for changing the watches. A ship without a functioning ampolletta was effectively disabled. Just above the pages in rank came the apprentices, the most expendable and vulnerable members of all the crew. Ranging in age from 17 to 20, they were the ones who sprang on the rigging the moment the captain ordered them to furl or unfurl the sail, or to scamper to the dangerous lookout posts atop the masts. They pulled on the oars in the longboats, and operated the complex mechanical devices aboard ship, the pulleys and cranes, the cables and anchors, the fixed and movable rigging. They teamed up to operate the capstan, rotating its drum with levers to load or unload heavy supplies, weapons, and ballast. They even shaved the legs and manicured the toenails of their masters, perhaps setting the stage for sexual relations between the two, even though such behavior was strictly forbidden. Apprentices were the group most likely to be disciplined, to be whipped for disobedience, or to be confined to the stocks for as long as a week. If an apprentice survived all the ordeals and hazards of life at sea, he could apply for certification as a sailor, receiving a document signed by the ship's pilot, bosun, and master. He was now a professional mariner and could look forward to a career lasting about 20 years, if he lived that long. Sailors advanced through the ranks by learning how to handle the helm, deploy the sounding line, splice cables, and, if they were mathematically inclined, marking charts and taking measurements of celestial objects to fix the ship's position. Most sailors were in their teens or 20s. Anyone who had reached his 30s was considered a veteran scalawag. By the time he had survived to that age, he had seen what life at sea held: brutality, loneliness, and disease. He had experienced flashes of camaraderie and heroism, as well as persistent dishonesty and callousness. He knew all about the avarice of shipowners, the uncomprehending indifference of kings under whose flags the expedition sailed, and the tyranny of captains. Men rarely went to sea beyond the age of 40. Magellan, nearly that age when he left Seville, was among the oldest, if not the oldest, person aboard the Armada de Malacca. No matter how high an ordinary sailor rose, he was outranked by specialists such as gunners, essential to expeditions exploring new lands. Skilled in the use of cannon, and in the preparation of gunpowder, and the selection of projectiles, a gunner tended to his weapons throughout the voyage. Less glamorous but equally necessary fields of specialization included carpenters, caulkers, and coopers. There was also a complement of divers aboard the fleet, whose job it was to swim under the ships and, when necessary, clear seaweed from the rudder and keel, and inspect the hull for signs of exterior damage and leaks. The ship's barber, another specialist, was deceptively named because trimming beards was the least of his responsibilities. He served as the onboard dentist, doctor, and surgeon, ministering to the crew out of his chest of nostrums, herbs, and folk remedies. No one answered to the description of cook aboard these ships because the job was considered too demeaning. One sailor telling another that his beard smelled of smoke was tantamount to provoking a fight. The crew took turns cooking or paid the apprentices to cook for them. And during foul weather, there was no cooking at all, and the sailors endured cold repasts of hardtack, salted meat, and wine. Officers ranked just above the sailors and specialists in the fleet's hierarchy. One tier consisted of the steward, charged with keeping an eye on the food supply, the bosun, or contramaestre, the bosun's mate, and the alguacil. The alguacil, for which there is no exact translation, served as the king's representative aboard the ship and military officer. If Magellan needed to arrest a crew member, he ordered the alguacil to perform the deed. This was not a job designed to endear him to the other crew members, and the alguacil stood apart from the rest of the crew. At the top of the pinnacle came the pilot, who plotted the ship's route, the master, who supervised the precious cargo, and finally the captain. Each of the top three officers had his own page, and his captain general, Magellan, had several, including his illegitimate son, and they lived a life as separate as possible from the rank-and-file sailors and apprentices. The officers had their own cabins, cramped, to be sure, but a mark of distinction, and they rarely ate with the crew. To most of the men aboard the fleet, even the flagship Trinidad, Ferdinand Magellan seemed a remote, imperious figure, authoritarian and arbitrary, a man whose every word was law, and on whose skill, luck, and good judgment their lives depended.